say nation, he said Islam. He said, but the Turkish way of Islam, together with Turkish language, we need to go and get our other brothers in Central Asia, Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan, bring them together and be one great Islamic Turkey. Not fanatic, you know, moderate Turkish way of Islamic, whatever is a Turkish way of Islamic. Now, the military regime in Turkey hated this guy. So he was wanted. There were already some trials. They wanted to put him in jail. Okay. He was going through all this period. Accident happens. And he's wanted. He's actually declared criminal, terrorist, anti-secularist by the Turkish government. Yet, mysteriously, after Susurluk incident, this guy, Fethullah Gulen, in a private golf stream, ends up in the United States of America, lands here in Washington, D.C. Huh. Why the United States? This is a great Turkic Republic, Islam. Why are you coming to U.S.? He hasn't left the United States since. This is since 1997. First, he was in Washington, D.C. area. They gave him a lavish house and let him set up his organization, Islamic organization. Currently, it's valued somewhere above $20 billion. It's the largest Islamic organization in the world, headquartered in the United States, okay? And I'm going to come back again if we have time to this character, but he's here in Washington, D.C. area and Pennsylvania. Who is his next neighbor? His next neighbor... This is, I'm laughing. It's because nobody ever touches these issues because they are told not to, as far as mainstream media goes. As far as alternative media goes, like, man, dude, this is so complicated. I can't get into that. Next to him is this guy called Yusuf Turani. Now, this is the guy who used to be in Xinjiang, Uyghuristan, Turkestan, and China. He was taken out of there. He lived for a while in Turkey. Then he came to the United States. He was given citizenship. And State Department brought him, and they had a meeting, and this is in 1997, and they declared independent country of Turkestan with the president of Turkestan in absentia. Like, nobody knows this, right? So you declare a country and a president in a meeting, an oval table in the State Department, we say, we are declaring Xinjiang, Turkestan, and here is the president. Now, he swears his oath of office is taken inside the building in the State Department in Washington, D.C. in 1997. Well, he's part of the same Gladio Plan B network, okay? So through him, because he's the leader in absentia, president in absentia of this country that really doesn't exist except in the eyes of the United States, Turkestan. So he was part of Plan B and still is part of Plan B, heading and carrying out operations, you know, through his people and network goes down in Xinjiang province of China. Now, between 1997, after he moved to the United States, this guy, this preacher, Fethullah Gulen, right, opened up 350 mosques and madrasas in Central Asia and Caucasus. 350, James, in 4 years. Nobody knows where the money is coming from. He says these are donations from good-hearted Turkish people. just take a look at it. I mean, if we don't even get that much, we don't even collect that much tax in Turkey. Like, even the government is unable by force to collect that much tax. So we got these $20 billion of network. So 350 mosques and madrasas. But because he preaches modern Islam, you know, not the fanatic Islam, he advocates teaching English to all his students, pupils in the madrasas, okay? You know, these are boys with Quran and they go like, but they have to learn English. And for the teaching of English for his organizations that he owns with mosques and madrasas, he needs to send English teachers to Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan and etc., right? But for some reason, hundreds of these English teachers that went have been going from the United States to these countries, Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan, etc., they all have diplomatic passports. Now, you taught English. Were you given diplomatic passports to teach English in Japan? Because this, again, people would say, oh, this is some allegation. No. And this is why I have had articles, I have translated articles, mainstream media in Europe and in Turkey, and it's there. It's already been proven. And they, United States, the State Department is not denying. They're saying because those countries are, you know, backwards and dangerous, they need diplomatic protections. Well, huh. Anyhow, Plan B, Gladio operations. These are, I'm giving the examples of what Plan B has been about. And this was when we, the United States, NATO, started really closely working with bin Laden and Zawahiri. And again, from what we knew in the FBI with some of the trips that Zawahiri took, the meetings with the high-level Turkish people in Turkey, several trips that Zawahiri took and went to Azerbaijan between 1997 and 2001. And while in Azerbaijan, he met with a lot of U.S. officials. It was sponsored and it held the meetings in Turkish embassy in Baku, Azerbaijan, with Zawahiri. Prince Bandar was there. It, a lot of the stuff that we got, I mean, bin Laden seemed to be number two. It was all Zawahiri. Believe me or not, it was Ayman Zawahiri. It was Zawahiri that came to Turkey and then went from Turkey to Albania to Kosovo. So anyhow, we, United States, together with Turkey, Turkish military faction of it, started working very closely in these countries with Ayman Zawahiri, bin Laden, Prince Bandar. Lots of meetings took place. And a lot of it was coordinated via, you know, the Turkish proxy. Well, these Turkish proxies were being investigated by the FBI. Not for that reason, for other reason. But inadvertently, we were getting this information through the recordings of whether it is, hypothetically speaking, Turkish military being wiretapped, or if it's a Turkish military attaché, diplomatic institutions, other various front organizations. So let's say you were via FISA, you were monitoring it, you being the FBI, to see if there are some espionage activities, etc. But while you're monitoring them, you're coming with mother loads of information. It has to do with, like, huh, you know? And another interesting thing that I have to mention here is, and nobody has ever mentioned this in public. Now, in the FBI, every single country, okay, every single country except four were wiretapped, were monitored under FISA. And by this, I mean all their diplomatic arms, you know. Let's say if it's a German embassy and a German military attaché in Washington, D.C., okay, under FISA. Four countries were exempt. They could not be monitored by the FBI under FISA that could be used in espionage and even criminal activities. You want to have a guess?
Can I take a stab at it?
A lot of people would say Israel.
It's not Israel. I'm going to guess Turkey is on that list.
It was until I started the official Turkish division for the FBI.
Right.
Prior to my employment with the FBI, the Pentagon sent this lieutenant colonel woman. She was a Turkish-American woman, NATO Pentagon liaison. They would send her every 2-3 months to come and randomly translate certain things for the FBI, because certain things were being recorded, but FBI couldn't have an official division, meaning they could never investigate criminally or for espionage. Turkey is one. All right. Three more.
Oh, no. Well, if it's going to play into what's happening in Central Asia and the Caucasus, it would have to be perhaps Pakistan?
No, we had a pretty good division of Pakistan. Because, you see, this included, that's why I gave the example of Germany, because this included European countries too. It was Turkey, Azerbaijan, United Kingdom. You would say it's English. What? United Kingdom is exempt, and for reasons, and that reason, and the fourth one is Belgium. Nobody in the FBI is allowed because there are too much sensitive stuff going on with Belgium. Okay, so these are the four. Now, Israel, we had a huge division, and FBI was extremely frustrated. They hated how investigations were being stopped, etc. But we had a huge division there in Israel, and we had so much on Israel. They had huge amount. Unfortunately, it could never be used, but they never, you know, they still collect. But no, not Israel, but it would be Turkey, Azerbaijan, and UK, and the Belgium. And again, as I said, the artery at the beginning of this interview, it was United States, Belgium, England, Turkey. And so anyhow, Fethullah Gulen still is here. He's still in Turkey. He has this huge castle built in Pennsylvania. He has opened.
Sorry, go on with that, I just want to spell that out for the audience out there in case they don't know. Of course, one of the implications of this, NATO's headquarters are in Brussels, in Belgium. This is the head of NATO itself. So again, just to spell that out for people in case they didn't quite get the implication of that.
Correct. Absolutely. And during the Susurluk investigation, some of the documents that came, you know, became public, the special office in Pentagon that was responsible for all this Gladio false flag, false terrorism operations, the exact division was spelled out in documents. I mean, they had a major office. There is a major division that oversees that. And as I said, they work with these thugs and criminals. And the fact that as people write and talk about it, it was not dismantled and just like left there after the end of the Soviet Union, after the fall of the Soviet Union. It went forward with the operations, and in 1997 it went to Plan B. And this is why, again, during the interviews I said, this is very interesting, because during this 3-4 years period, there were dozens and dozens of joint operation with individuals like Ayman Zawahiri, and it was never called Al-Qaeda. It was Mujahideen, headed by. And again, it's very interesting. When lately, you know, these leaders, these regimes we topple in these countries, they end up dead, so they cannot talk, or they end up sick with heart attacks. They can't talk, really have trials. You know, we saw it with Gaddafi. But again, one of the things that took place, and again, Turkey behind the scenes played a major role together with U.S., was we in the United States asked Mubarak, okay, to release some of the top fundamental anti-regime figures from prison in 1990s. And they came to Turkey, and they became part of this movement. When I say anti-regime, would be Mubarak had to release some fundamentals who were anti-Mubarak. And because the higher powers told him that we need these people in Turkey, and we have tasks for them, okay? You take a look and see how many times he's been released, people like Zawahiri. Anyhow, we had these, and then 9/11 happened. And this is when I kept saying these organizations, Turkey, these things come together, and people say, well, what does it have to do with Turkey? Turkey is an ally. Well, it would be crazy for someone to come out and say, you know, you look at NATO or certain arm of NATO. Nobody would listen to this person. Think about it. A president, ex-president of Italy, can come out publicly and talk about Gladio, and talk about some of the operatives, and talk about 9/11, and it's not even mentioned. How could 2-3 agents from the FBI, you get a couple of people in Pentagon, if they were to come out, and they were to come out and tell people, let's say they are fearless, okay? They say, execute me, put me in jail. I'm going to tell the Americans exactly what I know. People will say he's crazy or she's crazy. Americans, a lot of people in Europe, they would not be willing to digest information to them that big, but the answer yet so simple.
Well, let's spell this out for people, because you've talked about the plan A of Gladio, which is more, I think, what people understand Gladio to have been, talking about the ultranationalists. But moving into the plan B era with the Islamization of the Central Asia and Caucasus and working with people like Zawahiri, I guess the question a lot of people have is, how is this Gladio? Gladio was the stay behind to counter the Soviet threat. So the idea is, well, after the Soviet threat is gone, what is Gladio's purpose? So I guess the question is, well, what is Plan B? What is it actually attempting to achieve? I think we've gotten some indication with that. For example, the Azerbaijani example, trying to move the Azerbaijani government into the U.S. stable. But are there other examples? How is this actually being used, and what is its purpose at this point?
Okay, first, the fact that even though like the term stay behind applies, they're very proactive. This is, think about this. A lot of say, okay, Cold War then was over in 1991. Cold War was never over. It is not, it still continues. The war over resources, okay, continues. Not only that it did not end in 1990, it actually accelerated, okay? A lot of emphasis, attention today is on Middle East. Why Middle East oil, right? In less than a couple of decades, the next Middle East we're going to be seeing is going to be Central Asia, much worse, much bloodier, with much worse ethnic divisions, you know, divisiveness and conflicts there, because the amount of natural resources they have, whether it's oil or gas or minerals, it's because it's towards the end of it, what we see in Middle East. They are almost done with. Okay, we still have the unexplored regions within the Caspian Basin. We still have Iran, yeah. But the ultimate prize has always been Central Asia and Caucasus. If you go back to Brzezinski, if you go back to all the doctrine, you would see that said Eurasia. It's not. Middle East is the past. It's over. It's a finished chapter. They like what they are seeing. People, we are stuck by watching, observing Middle East, and nobody's paying attention. What is happening? How the countries are being set up in Central Asia and Caucasus. How we are already setting up the religious factions there, okay? How we are setting up the ethnic conflicts there. You need to do this preparation for the coming assault that going for it. It doesn't happen overnight, you know? People are looking Mubarak. I remember 1980, 1981. I remember how it was discussed in Iran, in Turkey, of who killed Anwar Sadat. It was, the biggest thing was, it was Mubarak. Who wanted Mubarak to implement that? It was always the United States. So, but today it's like, oh yeah, this big bad guy, Mubarak, he's in jail. They don't know the context. They are currently, are people missing the context of what we are doing. 9/11 happens, okay? 9/11 happens. We say, our government says, our partners did it, okay? While we were working with them, carrying joint operations all over the place in Central Asia and Caucasus, they turn around and they did this to us. It's, as I said, it seems complicated. It's too big to digest. Yet it's extremely simple. And simplicity doesn't matter. People don't want to digest, no matter how simple it is. Our partners, look, we are partnering up in Syria. It's nothing. I'm talking about real partnership. Operations carried out over resources, trying to get these ex-Soviet blocs on our side so they won't be on Russia's side, so they won't be on China's side. Because, hey, communist China, Muslims should side with America. Because Islam works in our benefit. What do we have to get these people? Through our proxy, Turkish, NATO, Islam. As long as they become fanatics, as long as they're attached to Islam, they're going to say poo-poo to China and Russia. They're going to side with us. What happened in Afghanistan? It was Islam. It's always been. It's been the oldest trick for UK. It's been the number one big game. It played in the name of religion. You use Islam to get what you want. And I'm just amazed. I'm opening newspapers. I don't actually open newspapers anymore. I open them on my computer, but I still do this motion. I don't buy newspapers. But count how many times do you see the word Islam and Islamists. Islamists carried out this, Islamists did that, Islamists, and this Islamist faction, Islamists. You know, I mean, if you look at some of the conflicts with India and Pakistan, you don't see Buddhists did that. So Buddhist, you know, you don't see Buddhists did this. It's you know, a particular group, but it's Islamists.
Absolutely, so, right. I mean, we see the absolute Islamization of the area and the 350 madrasas that Gulen has put into that region, and with the English teachers being sent over with diplomatic passports. It all lines up exactly as you're saying, but there's another huge piece of this puzzle that we haven't even touched on yet, and that's the drug running, which of course is absolutely central to a lot of the geostrategy of the region, and of course Turkey absolutely important in terms of smuggling for the heroin routes. A lot of money rests on this. This is such a huge backbone of the international economy, and of course that's one of the things that we're not allowed to ever talk about or breach or broach in the mainstream media, because it is so central to what's happening there. So how does this fit in? Who are the main players, and where do they fit into this network that's been created?
Sure. First of all, I have to first say, I know the information. I know both through the work I did during the short period of time with the FBI that involved the top Turkish operators and movement of heroin, and this is before 9/11 until a few months after 9/11, but also my own research, but also my own contacts and sources in Turkey. But as far as my work, during my work with the FBI goes, and the information that by default we gathered, because some of these Turkish actors under investigations who were being monitored, they were the major players with bringing in heroin. And it was again done, believe me or not. It's like, okay, Turkey, Eastern Europe, nobody ever mentions their role and the strategic importance of Brussels. Brussels is extremely important in the transportation and in the distribution of heroin. But nobody would want to think about, oh, Brussels, European country, Belgium, it just doesn't fit. We need to find countries like Pakistan and Turkey. Yeah, Midnight Express, that makes sense. But UK, you know, Belgium, that's not, that doesn't. But one false information that is being put that I have to correct here by people is Taliban ended the opium production, the puppies production, and then after 9/11 it started. Of course, after 9/11 it went from $5 billion worth or $1 billion worth to $50, $100 billion, increased tremendously, but they never ceased producing. And I noticed firsthand, and I noticed through my work with the FBI, it is a known thing. They still did. It was nothing like to this extent, the scale that it is today, the production of the opium heroin, but it was there. However, until 9/11, the majority of that operation, and again, it was nothing compared to what it is today, the biggest share was actually carried out, both operations, taking it to the labs by the Russians. If I were to throw a number, I would say it was 70 to 80% was under Russian control in 1990s. This is Russian mafia, certain Russian military elements, certain Russian intelligence elements. They cared that they had a lot of network put in place even after they got out of Afghanistan, and they continued that. And something around, again, don't quote me on the number. If I were to throw a number, I would say somewhere around 20% was being smuggled through porous borders region into Iran, from Iran into Turkey, some of them through Kurdish couriers into Iraq, from Iraq to Turkey, where the lab processed it, but it was 20 to 80. Now, that turned completely opposite after 9/11, okay? We, the West, via Turkey, you know, Albanians and Turks, the West became, and this is the number one actor at the top being NATO, the biggest shareholder, the top people in this operation that now you're saying 50, 100, 500 billion, pick your number. And the Russians' share decreased and decreased and decreased and decreased to almost nothing. I mean, they still have some. They are some Russian, but it's nothing. And that's why, again, this is fact. This is solid data. pouring in. Who were the actors? How much of the share it was and how much it is. Now, this is why I wonder sometimes when Russia screams and says all this heroin comes into Russia and we want to be part of this eradication program that has increased the poppy production into whatever, 50 billion. I guess we call it now eradication, increasing the production. I'm like, maybe it's a code language. Russia says we want in on this. And maybe to pacify Russia, we say, yeah, we are eradicating and the production is going up. Come, we'll give you another 10%. Help us eradicate, puppies. So that's for the heroin portion of it. And while we are at this on this topic of Russia, and I want to mention this, and I find this mind-boggling. The our operations, Gladio operations, U.S. NATO via these Turkish paramilitary groups, and later via the Islamist groups, a lot of it had to do with what we were doing with the Chechens and the Chechen movements and the Chechnya carrying out terror attacks in Russia, a lot of it within Russian borders. Now, then we're going to get into Ergenekon, and I don't know how much time we have. It may be part two for this interview, because a lot of these former ultranationalist fascist militaries who used to fight Russia or counter the Soviet on Gladio's side, after they were basically thrown out, started being assassinated, you know, they were thrown out by NATO and they lost their protections, and these are the military fascists in Turkey, the ones who survived, they had to get themselves into, you know, to Russia, and they defected to Russia. They went and they sought political asylums. You will see several Turkish generals who've been in Russia in the past 3-4 years, with all the trial against the Turkish generals, Ergenekon in Turkey, and with some of these people being assassinated mysteriously, including some of the paramilitary groups, in order to defect, in order to get the asylum, in order to settle and get the Russian government protection. Of course, they had to give, I'm certain, a lot of information to the Russian government and to FSB. And even in late 1990s, as the Russian forces were capturing and killing some of these terrorists, you know, their terrorists, they were confiscating passports, diplomatic passports, Turkish passports on so-called Chechens who either received training in Turkey or actually these were part of the Turkish military, paramilitary groups fighting and leading Chechens inside Russia to carry out terror attacks. And the mystery remains that why Russia has remained so quiet and silent on this. And what is the game there? Or is this actually a game changer? I don't know.
Now we continue with part two.
Well, let's pick up where we left off last time. We really did cover quite a bit about the ultranationalists and how that was used in Operation Gladio in Turkey in the 1960s, 70s, 80s, and how that leads into the current time frame. And we talked a bit about the current era, the War on Terror, but let's start getting more into that specifically. And there's a couple of news stories that have just occurred in the last couple of weeks that might provide a good starting point or an entree to this conversation. And I want to start with the recent bombing in Ankara of the U.S. Embassy. And people might have followed this story, but some of the details that have come out are at least the way they're being framed in the mainstream media are quite interesting. For example, we have this from the Times of Israel from last week. Turkey, embassy bombers cling to Cold War ideology. And it says some speculate that the DHKPC targeted the old imperialist nemesis of leftist radicals everywhere in efforts to oust Assad. And this article starts by saying, long before Al-Qaeda, when the Cold War gripped the world, leftist terrorists staged spectacular attacks in a doomed campaign to overthrow governments and impose their vision of a socialist utopia. The bulk of these extremist groups eventually drifted into oblivion, gutted by police pressure, internal rifts, and an ideology undercut by communism's fall. In Turkey, one cult-like group didn't get the memo. And it goes on to talk about how this group, the Revolutionary People's Liberation Party Front, or the DHKPC, is responsible for this bombing. Sibel, what do you make of this bombing and how it's being framed right now in terms of this Cold War ideology leftover of the socialist radicals?
It's very interesting because you can't really get to the bottom of what's going on there, as you said, with all these conflicting reports that is coming out on this attack. And as far as Turkey and Turkish media and the Turkish government goes, whenever they say left and the communists and these groups and these cults, they're always talking about Russia. And another way they framed this latest incident was tie it again to Syria and to Assad, because these people are very pissed off. They are very angry with Turkish government's support of the United States and the foreign influence there to oust Assad. And, well, let's see. They are communist. They are leftist. They are pro-Assad. And so, and then we have had one superpower or former superpower who has been stepping in and saying, no, you can't attack Syria, and has been an obstacle to some of our plans for Syria. And that is who? Russia. So it starts coming all together. And in a way, maybe it's an indirect message, because I'm sure they get the direct message through different channels to Russia, saying, okay, well, we're going to have some of these incidents and you're going to start looking really bad internationally. And so that's what it looks like. The most important thing in terms of timing on this is the recent report. The mainstream media is not really playing it big yet, and not in the United States. It's huge in Turkey, and it's very big in the rest of Middle East. All these Arabic publications from Egypt to Saudi Arabia to even Pakistan, and that is the recent arrest and immediate release of Bin Laden's son-in-law. Well, this guy, Bin Laden's son-in-law, since 2000, actually has been most wanted internationally. And if you recall, Bin Laden really never directly claimed responsibility for 9/11. It has never been this clear claim of responsibility for 9/11. On the other hand, this guy, Bin Laden's son-in-law, who's supposed to be among top five Al-Qaeda leaders and number two spokesperson for so-called Al-Qaeda, and this is Bin Laden's son-in-law, he is the one who did the highest number of these so-called videos that kept popping up between 2001, 9/11, and 2008. At least six or seven videos came out that this guy was saying, okay, we did great, and in some ways claiming responsibility for 9/11, and then coming and threatening over Iraq and everything. So this guy has been wanted, and the rumor has been, or had been until recently, that he was in Iran, of all places. Now, you have to remember, Iran has never, ever had good relations or any relationship with Al-Qaeda. There were certain geographic locations in Iran that had high level of activities, but that area is considered the no man's zone, and that is Sistan and Balochistan, okay? And that is shared by Pakistan as well. And we know that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed has been active there, including Bin Laden, Bin Laden's son-in-law. On and off, this region has been very important, and this region also has been very important for the United States. We have been doing a lot of things in Balochistan. Balochistan, just like Xinjiang that I mentioned, is another area that you don't hear much report. All we know as Americans in general is that there are all these terror incidents. There are people who want independence. Pakistan, they are abusing them, they are oppressing them, and so anyhow, Balochistan system, but not Iran. You're looking at Sunni faction, and these are the Wahhabis. This is Bin Laden. You're looking Iran Shias. Iran and Bin Laden and or so-called Al-Qaeda, they've never had anything jointly, nothing. In fact, during the time when I was in the FBI after 9/11, we, the United States, we tried very hard to find something to link Iran to 9/11. And they couldn't. I mean, they couldn't even make it up. I mean, it was that far-fetched. However, the rumor has been, and I have no idea how it started. Usually, we don't have any idea how these things start. It just gets to be placed out there. Then it circulates, was that Bin Laden's son-in-law went to Iran. He was arrested in Iran, and Iran is holding several key Al-Qaeda members in either prisons or some sort of house arrest in Iran. never confirmed, never shred of evidence. Anyhow, in February, and that will be on February 2nd or 3rd, here's the headline saying, Bin Laden's son-in-law was arrested in Turkey by Turkish authority. And he was, and this is Bin Laden's son-in-law, he was staying at this five-star hotel, only two blocks from the presidential palace, in a way hiding there in a five-star, it's a penthouse room, according to the Turkish media. And how did this happen? So you have Bin Laden's son-in-law, one of the top five al-Qaeda leaders, most wanted or wanted by the international community. And he is in this penthouse in this hotel in capital city of Turkey, two blocks from the presidential palace. And the story that Turkish government fed to the media was, this is how it happened. They being the Turkish government, they got a call from the CIA. And CIA said, we want to give you a very important information. Bin Laden's son-in-law, our most wanted guy, he, maybe with my backpack or something, the guy who was staying in a five-star hotel, he crossed the border from Iran, recently entered Turkey. In fact, we know where he's staying. Here's the name of his hotel and his room number. And Turkish authority, they said, whoo! So they stormed the hotel room, the penthouse unit, two blocks from the presidential palace. They took this guy and questioned him, interrogated him. Temporarily, they held him. And again, it's very interesting. It's not a regular criminal or terrorism-related police station. It's in a totally different political intelligence-related station that they held him. Then they said they don't have any evidence indicating that this guy, Bin Laden's son-in-law, the internationally most wanted guy, al-Qaeda's number four or number five, has done anything against Turkey or has threatened Turkish security in any way. And because of that, they were going to release him. Then the articles, these newspapers in Turkey, they're saying, well, the U.S. said, but we want him. We want him in Guantanamo. I mean, this guy, imagine how much information he has on 9/11. As you know, we've never been able to have anyone in court. They are either dead or they have disappeared. Not a single person. So we want him. Give this guy to us. And Turkey said, sorry, we don't have this extradition treaty with you. And as we said, this guy hasn't done anything to us, so we are not going to give him, hand him to you. And the CIA and the State Department, the U.S. government said, oh, okay, we are not happy, but fine. Now, as I said...
And keep in mind, this is the same CIA that has abducted citizens from other countries that they have nothing to do with, including famously in Italy and other places, and flown them halfway across the world to torture them. But they won't do that with this person, apparently.
First of all, is Turkey. And Turkey has been one of our top allies in detaining most of them innocent people, putting them in these black sites and torturing them, taking them into Guantanamo. Since when we are paying attention to some sorts of international rules like extradition treaties? After all, as you said, we had our Gulf Stream with our CIA psychopaths with ski masks landing in Sweden and saying, we want that guy, that guy, that guy. And Sweden says, yes. And they just, you know, put chains around their ankles and they hand them over. No evidence sought. Okay? This is what we've been doing. And then we basically, it's out that 99% of people in Guantanamo, we have no evidence against these people. They have nothing to do with al-Qaeda. Now, yet, based on our own claim, this is one of the top al-Qaeda people. Basically, it was what? Bin Laden, Zawahiri, Mullah Omar from Taliban side. This guy is number four or number five and is wanted. Turkey says, we're not going to give him to you. And none of our rendition stuff applies to this. We don't want this guy. Why don't we want this guy? And that is the question that people should be asking. But then again, where is it? The news and analysis of this incident here in the United States for people to even look at and then ask a question. But again, very important because you're looking at, again, Turkey. You're looking at a high level, now so-called al-Qaeda leader. And as we get into the topics from where we left last time, you keep seeing the same pattern. You're going to keep seeing the same pattern again. Another top guy that we declared later as top Al-Qaeda financier and terrorist, and that was Yasin Al-Qadi. And people may recognize it via PTEC and the PTEC incident. Well, Yasin Al-Qadi, after 9/11, without being touched, he left the United States, went for a while, for about 6 to 8 months, and lived in Albania. He has Albanian passport. From Albania, he went to Turkey, okay? And while he was in Turkey, you know, he still operated. He was totally, completely operational. And the United States did the same thing. They asked Turkey, they said, we want this guy. We want Al-Qadi. Look, he is wanted. His financial network is wanted. And same thing. Turkey said, oh, sorry. There is nothing here that indicates he has done anything criminal or terrorist related here in Turkey. We're not going to give him to you. And so he very nicely settled there with all his operations and networks, and he's been operational. And now currently he's in the United Kingdom because he basically brought these lawsuits against the United Nations. And finally, a few months ago or a year ago, United Nations said, okay, well, fine, he's not really a terrorist. Nobody has any evidence or anything either for the argument of terrorists or not. But again, you're looking at Turkey, and when you start looking, you're going to see a lot of these characters, you're going to see a lot of these people ending up in Turkey and being protected in Turkey with our okay, because as we said, take a look at the recent reports and see how Turkey has been very, very readily complying with all these illegal practices of black sites, rendition, and you will see that on one hand they've been doing it, but why with the so-called important characters, Turkey has been a great haven for these people to go and continue their network and their operations.
Well, let's focus in on that Al-Qadi case for a little bit, because it is such a fascinating story. And of course, immediately in the wake of 9/11, the U.S. was putting together its list of specially designated terrorists and specifically looking at financiers of terrorism. And Al-Qadi made that list in October of 2001. So immediately after 9/11, he's put on that list. And as you indicate, in the last 4 to 5 years, he's managed to clear himself from blacklists in Switzerland, the European Union, the United Kingdom, and has managed to fend off lawsuits from 9/11 victims' family members for any culpability so far. But he has not yet been removed from the U.S. specially designated terrorist list. And part of the investigation that put him on that list goes back to an FBI investigation from the late 1990s called Operation Vulgar Betrayal, which was led by a couple of agents that were in that FBI Chicago office. I don't know what you're able to say about those investigations, but perhaps you can tell us a little bit about that story.
Sure. The agents Robert Wright and also John Vincent, they became members of our organization, National Security Whistleblowers Coalition. And because Robert Wright was still working, he's still working with the FBI. And during this time, this would be 2003, 2004, he was under a lot of retaliation and punishment for what he did by coming and exposing this terrorist network, including their investigations and the fact that the United States government, this won't be FBI itself, but entities such as White House and the State Department and the CIA, they were forced to shut down this very, very important investigations that, again, would have led us to all the actors and the evidence that were involved in later in 9/11. So this guy was under retaliation, so he couldn't become officially a member of my organization, our organization, National Security Whistleblowers Coalition, but his partner, because these two guys, they did all this, they chased these bad guys together in Chicago field office, and that would be John Vincent. He, by then, was retired, and he joined our organization, and he and I had a lot of discussions on this, and we worked together on all this whistleblowers and 9/11-related issues. And again, John Vincent was one of many, many high-level agents who went to the 9/11 Commission. And they said, let us present you with the evidence of all the things that hasn't been out yet, that is related to 9/11. And like many others, he had been excluded. Same thing with Agent Wright. The FBI said the 9/11 commission is not allowed to question him. So he was never interviewed by 9/11, okay? And he's a very key guy with a key operation that and a key investigation of that operation. And same thing with John Vinson. So this is happening. And as I said, I keep saying Chicago and Chicago because with Plan B, with Gladio, a lot of the operational and logistic aspects of Gladio Plan B was being conducted from Chicago. Chicago is the top, the best, the easiest city for money laundering, okay? Because of huge level of corruption within the local, the state government, Illinois, but also Chicago political figures. And again, it came out with Dennis Hastert. Very little of it has come out. But it is the easiest place to for these operations. It's a very good base in the U.S. And I want to emphasize one thing that I realized from some of the questions I got on Gladio Plan B was that, you know, this, how this, does it even, how can we even claim that U.S. is involved with this Gladio operations because it was Italian? B, the United States has an office in Pentagon. Okay, this office has a number, has a specific name. It's not called the Gladio Plan B office, but it is a designated section in Pentagon that only deals with these Plan B operations for Gladio, which is the via Turkish actors and all the stuff we are doing in Caucasus. And before that, that same office, physical office section of Pentagon dealt with the previous operations of Gladio, not only till 1989, all the way up to 1995, 1996. So there's actually a physical division and office. So it's not some assumption or some conclusion. There is an office. There is a division, okay? Now, with Chicago, this is when I was working with the FBI, and you said October for Cotty leaving the United States. And again, he left. A lot of Bin Laden family members, business associates, they left without being questioned. Cotty was not questioned either. Starting from the 2-3 days after 9/11, we had this quota that the FBI had to meet. And that was to round up as many people as possible, immigration violation, even the tiniest one, to show in the newspaper all the arrests we were making and interrogations that we were conducting. And these were nobodies. It was some guy who violated a traffic rule, and they realized his green card was expired. He may be involved in 9/11. We're going to interrogate him. And taking all the resources away from the FBI, while you had all these top people with Bin Laden last names, Bin Laden's known associates, Cotty, nobody ever questioned them. Nobody ever detained them. They just had their first class tickets or they had their private jets, and they just were out of here when they wanted. Nobody touched them. Okay, that's another very important side of aspect of all this 9/11 enigma. So this is when they are chasing in mid to late 1990s, John Vincent and Agent Robert Wright. They are chasing Cotty under counterterrorism division. Okay, they were with counterterrorism division, but a lot of their work also involved because it spilled over to the white collar crime division for the FBI Chicago field office, because a lot of Cotty and these so-called terrorists, they were also involved in massive amount of money laundering, and there were a lot of financial aspects of it. So you have Chicago counterterrorism involved with this. You have Chicago white collar crime division involved with this. Meanwhile, I'm in Washington, D.C. The main operation I'm translating for has to do with the Washington, D.C. field office's Turkish counterintelligence agent, Dennis Thatcher. Again, if you read, if you have read my book or if you read my book, you will see all the detailed description of this. However, because I was the only one translating for Turkish and Turkic languages, I also worked with field agents from other cities and towns, and that included Chicago in Illinois. And that became my second biggest case that I was working with. And that was with Agent Joel Roberts. And this guy, he was not with the counterterrorism division in Chicago. He had his case that he's been chasing since 1996 in Chicago, but that was under Turkish counterintelligence with targets that were included, the person we discussed here, Abdullah Çatlı, who was living in Chicago, and Çatlı's associates. These are all NATO Plan B, Gladio Plan B operatives that were doing a lot of things in Chicago, and they had their base in Chicago, and we discussed that. They went to Xinjiang from there. They went to Azerbaijan for assassination attempts. So while these agents in Chicago for Turkish counterintelligence, they're chasing this Turkish terrorist, narcotics, criminal espionage entities, a lot of that overlaps with what Agent Wright and John Vincent were chasing with Al-Qaeda. And these were the mostly Arabic speaking and Saudi Arabia rooted individuals who had, again, there were a bunch of things there, financial crime, terrorism related, etc. In Washington, D.C., again, it was certain diplomatic targets with Turkey. The most important thing for people to get in this is we are not even looking at, you know, one big investigations, all these agents working together. They were chopped off and divided. But because I worked in the central place, and even other field offices, whether it's someone in Illinois, Chicago, or someone from New Jersey, they were sending their material to me, or the Turkey portion of it, or Turkey-related portion of it. I was in this position to see all the dots being connected and going to my agent and say to Dennis Sasher in Washington, D.C., and say, you may want to talk with this guy, Robert Wright, or Joel Roberts in Chicago, because they have the other pieces of what you're working on. And that's exactly what took place with some of these investigations. These agents, while I was there, because I was the central person, they started connecting the dots. So I leave it here before I make things more complicated.
All right. Well, let's focus on the national aspect of this. Of course, you were looking specifically at Turkish diplomatic targets of the FBI, and that was related to some of this. But you mentioned that Al-Qaeda had an Albanian passport. Is that particularly relevant?
Yes, it is. Because absolutely. Because same, whether it's Abdullah Çatlı, whether it's Al-Qaeda, and whether with some of these other Turkish NATO operatives that we were monitoring within the FBI, in between early 1990s till about 1996-97, the biggest focus of these operatives was on the Balkans. And we know what was happening during this time. We had Bosnia, we had Kosovo. I mean, this was when these mujahideens that were being mysteriously, nobody ever gets into the details. They cross the borders and they end up in the Balkans. How do they end up in the Balkans? Coming from Pakistan, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, via Turkey, into this region and fighting. So, and this was, when I say they are all connected, Abdullah Çatlı and Qadi, well, a lot of the focus during that early portion of mid-1990s was on the Balkans. And this was when these individuals were going to that region and coming back, and the networks were bringing these mujahideens, not Al-Qaeda, they were not called Al-Qaeda, from those regions into. And if you look at later to Fethullah Gulen and madrasas and mosques by him, again, you will see Fethullah Gulen all over this region. Same thing. And another interesting aspect is this is the period of time where a lot of Albanians poured into the United States, okay? And this was when they started really establishing themselves as the most ferocious and strongest mafias in the United States. And again, a lot of their activities were centered in where? Chicago. Okay. Because the network that brought the heroin to Europe, it was Turkish-Albanian network. So this is once it comes out of Turkey, it goes into the Balkans, it goes to Brussels, goes to UK, but then it comes to the United States. The United States is a huge market for heroin. And if you look at this particular period, you would see the top mafia operators in the United States were Albanians. And this was when Italians said, whoa, even we don't or won't mess with these Albanians. Well, who were these Albanians exactly? And how were they able to bring? And how come every time we, the FBI, together and sometimes jointly with DEA, there would be an operation, they would go completely untouched, whether when the actors involved were Turkish or they were Albanians. Now, with Turkish actors, we had several incidents. While I was in the FBI, there would be a joint sting operation, okay? They're going to have a bus, and this is FBI and DEA, joint operations. They know the location, they know the actors, and 9:30 a.m., they're going to be there, they're going to bust these guys, right? They get into their SUVs and the vans, and this includes my agent, some of the agents I work with. They're going to meet their DEA counterparts and make the bust, right? 15 minutes before the bus, while they're on the way, they get a call from the top tier, top layer in the FBI saying, operation finished, over. Come back to the office and get the DEA's guys off this. And the agents would be absolutely livid saying, what and why? Well, it's because the State Department told us they have diplomatic immunities and it will be diplomatic incidents. Now, the first question people should ask is, how in the world did the CIA and the State Department in each case, you know, how did they find out about the fact that we were monitoring them and there would be a sting operation, right? And this is, again, another topic that is not really talked about, and that is Colleen Rowley. And one of the things maybe we will do for this video, I will find that interview and or the article where Colleen Rowley came and said, I'm not joking. I believe in FBI, there were so many moles. And some of these moles were Al-Qaeda-related moles. Because that's the only explanation I have been able to come up with. And this is Colleen Rowley's, okay, senior FBI, currently retired, her quote. Well, that was the thing. We had the moles and people immediately assume there will be Russian moles. I mean, even with this Jan Dickerson case, Turkish mole, these are the moles who work for foreign governments. That was not the case. Or in these cases, that was not the case. Because in these cases, we had moles, whether within the management, whether within the headquarters or within the translation divisions, that were placed there strategically by the State Department and the CIA. CIA wanted to know at any given moment what FBI was doing, how much they had, and what they were planning to do. Okay? On the other hand, if you look the other way and say how many people from the FBI had penetrated the CIA, you would get this, zilch, zero. So, right, there is a sting operation, maybe maximum of 6, 7, 10 people know about this. And the top layer guy in the FBI says, you're coming back to the headquarters, we are calling off the operations, they have the targets that you're about to bust, they have diplomatic immunities. Who says that? State Department. How does State Department know? There is nothing there. No explanation on that. How many DEA agents know about this? I would say at least a dozen of DEA agents today would tell you about several incidents where the State Department, CIA would come and prevent their operations when they would get close in the sting operations. They would tell you about cases where the CIA, State Department would actually go tip off the targets that DEA was after or the FBI. There are dozens of cases, not only within the Turkish department, but I do have many DEA, former DEA agents. It's a norm. If you were to ask senior DEA agents, the biggest enemies you've had in doing your job, you know, preventing you from going after the big guys or doing real busts, I'm not talking about street level drug dealers, they would tell you, yeah, State Department, aka CIA.
And that's where we leave it this time. Due to the time constraint, we should probably pick up where we left off in our next episode. Meanwhile, this and all previous episodes are available for download from our MP3 archive at unwelcomeguests.net/archive. Our theme tune is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie.